The North Sound Energy Week with Active Payroll. Become part of an award-winning team. Go to activepayroll.com/careers for your next move.
Hello, and after a few weeks' break, welcome back to the North Sound Energy Week podcast. I'm Finlay Duncan. This week, industry backing for a major new oil field. North Sound gets first-hand access to the North Sea's three main helicopter operators, and oil bosses asked for their thoughts on the independence referendum. But first, energy bosses say a recent major North Sea field being given the go-ahead is the sign of what can be done when governments work with industry. Ministers in London approved development of the Kraken field off Shetland last week, securing billions of pounds of investment. Oil and Gas UK's operations director, Una Verngren, says the EnQuest project is positive.
We think it's really good news. It's a major development. It's east of Shetlands. In fact, it's probably the largest investment that we've seen, certainly in the North Sea, this year. And what's important to the industry is that it's going to bring jobs across the supply chain, both during the construction phase of the vessel, but also longer term, once the field goes operational from 2016-2017 timeframe, there's going to be a significant number of jobs involved in operating and maintaining the vessel for about 25 years. So we've got another major project being developed in the North Sea at a critical time. And from my perspective, it also demonstrates that when government and industry work together, we can still deliver significant projects for the North Sea.
The Kraken field, they've long known that there was oil there, but it's only now that they're able to develop it and get it out of the ground.
That's right. It's heavy oil. That means that it's taken a long time to plan. It takes different technology in order to develop it. But we've got some really relatively new and exciting companies coming into the North Sea and demonstrating that there is a future here. And that's got to be good news for the North Sea.
Fantastic as well with the numbers of jobs that are expected to be brought with this development. But we talk about a skills shortage in the sector. How difficult is it going to be for the industry to actually fill these roles?
There's a lot of work going on right now around trying to attract a large number of people into the industry. We're interested in apprenticeships. We want graduates to get excited about the industry. We're looking at bringing in people from the military in order to provide jobs for the industry. So I think people should be looking at this and saying, here is an opportunity. Have I got the right skill set to get involved in an exciting project like this?
A Russian judge this week refused to free one of 30 people arrested after a Greenpeace protest over oil drilling in the Arctic. Australian activist Colin Russell was the first to have his case heard following the demonstration in September. The Coast Guard in Russia seized a Greenpeace ship and arrested everyone on board after some of the campaigners tried to scale an offshore drilling platform owned by the state energy firm Gazprom. Detainees have been charged with hooliganism, which carries a maximum sentence of 7 years. Initially, they were charged with piracy, a more serious offence, though investigators have said those charges will be dropped. An engineering and construction company secured a framework deal from Statoil. Technip will carry out the work related to the future Edvard Grieg pipeline and Utsira High gas pipeline. The contract's expected to be completed in the second half of 2015. Sirion Wood is giving £500,000 to set up Aberdeen's Oil and Gas Institute. The whole venture is going to cost £8 million. Sirion says the institute at RGU will serve as an important focus for the sector as a whole. The oil boss last week revealed his plans to maximise the potential of UK oil and gas. EU energy bosses have visited Aberdeen as the city bids for funding for hydrogen buses. The city council's leading a Scotland-wide project applying for European money to develop a fleet of 100 vehicles. Fuel cell technology is already set to be deployed in some buses here next year. Barney Crockett, the council's leader, says it's important we diversify from oil and gas.
Well, I think, Aberdeen will be the focal point for it. I mean, I think that the majority would be deployed, I'm sure, in Aberdeen because we'll have the structure, for it. We'll have refilling station and so forth that can make it all happen. We're, creating a world quality centre for hydrogen in the city. I think that we've got a number of projects that are ongoing and a number that we're already involved in. And I think the whole of Europe is looking to us for a lead in this matter.
Obviously known as the oil capital of Europe, how important is it for the city to diversify the kind of energy that it has expertise in?
Well, I think that what's important is we show that we've got a leading role in energy, that we're pioneering. Yes, so oil and gas, I think, will always be the centrepiece there, or be centrepiece for many, many decades. But we have to prove that we're open to leadership in other fields of energy, and I think our universities are doing that, and the City Council is very much involved in that as well.
So this offer of funding then, does the City Council have to apply to the EU for this? How does it work?
Yeah, well, I mean, we have very close links with the European Union in funding. I think people in Aberdeen would be surprised to know that we've had, you know, well over £100 million in funding for energy projects in the city. And we've built up a reputation within the EU as being, you know, a leading city, perhaps the leading city in the EU in energy innovation. And, you know, that's what we're taking forward here, again, taking the lead once more.
Scottish oil and gas exports are worth more than £30 billion. That's last year's estimate from economists at the Scottish Government. More than half of that was sent abroad. It's the first time total hydrocarbon exports have been counted up by officials. Production at a North Sea field is beginning this week. ConocoPhillips announced the Jasmine area to start producing, with Scotland's Energy Minister welcoming the news. MSP Fergus Ewing says it provides a further boost to the industry, following on from other recent investment announcements. The first of 30 people arrested during environmental protests in Arctic later this week walked free on bail in Russia. 28 activists and two journalists were arrested in the Greenpeace demonstration. 19 of those held in September by Coast Guards were granted bail this week. The North Sea's three main helicopter operators this week gave North Sound a first-hand look at how they're making sure safety is their top priority. Bristow, CHC and Bond have allowed us access to their operations as the industry prepares for its busiest time of the year, getting people home for the holidays. They're also keen to respond to concerns among the workforce about the aircrafts in the wake of three serious incidents in the past 18 months. Bristow's offshore flight operations manager, Matt Rhodes, says unlike planes, jobbers have to return to base even in the event of minor technical issues.
OK, so once they've completed the flight planning process, the commander of the aircraft will go down to the engineering line office. He'll sign for the aircraft itself to take responsibility for the aircraft and make sure there are no defects or any issues, and also to check to see if any maintenance has been done on the aircraft overnight. The co-pilot will then go out and do the walk around for the aircraft. So basically they're just having a quick look around the outside to make sure that everything is as it's supposed to be. Once they get in the aircraft as a crew, they then go through the startup process. And when they start the aircraft up, they're going through all the aircraft systems to make sure they're operating and functioning correctly.
When it comes to flying to, like we mentioned, remote destinations such as the rigs, I mean, you mentioned all operators now use a satellite tracking system. How much of a difference does that make for both the pilots themselves out there flying the craft, but for the operations back here in Aberdeen?
It's useful on several fronts. From an operations point of view, we have an understanding and a knowledge of where all our aircraft are at any one moment in time, enables us to track them. And the communication that we have will enable us to pass on any operational changes that may take place. So, for example, if the weather starts to deteriorate back at base, then we can contact the crews and let them know. If our clients require them to reroute for any reason, say they have a compassionate case offshore, they want to pick somebody up from another platform, then again we can get in contact with the pilots to advise them that there needs to be a change of routing. They'd then consider the fuel calculations, the weather conditions, and determine as to whether or not it was safe to do so.
One of the main differences that I think I noticed when it comes to if there's a problem, like you mentioned with planes, it tends to be that there will be engineers waiting at the destination because helicopters are flying to platforms that may not be that. Is that essentially then why we might see perhaps more reports of helicopters returning to Aberdeen because that's where the engineers are rather than being able to complete their journey?
Absolutely. The analogy that I use is for the fixed-wing world. When they depart from Aberdeen, for example, flying to Heathrow or Gatwick, they have a maintenance base there. So when they arrive, if they have a technical issue en route, they have engineers to meet the aircraft. The problem that we have operating to these remote destinations, such as oil platforms, is that we don't have the engineering support available there. So once we're in flight, if an issue does develop on flight, and it can be something as simple as a bulb blowing in the aircraft, it's safer and easier for us to return to base, get our main engineering support to look at the problem, certify the aircraft fit to fly again, and then continue on with the flight.
Lee James from CHC says they've got a new test which was introduced just last year.
Before first flight of the day, there's an inspection by an engineer, and then before the pilot takes acceptance of it, he will again perform a walk round. Then they will go and do the sector offshore, and they'll come back, and then the engineers will perform a turnaround inspection, which is the same level of inspection where they will ensure that the aircraft is clear for the next flight. At the end of the day, there's an after-flight inspection, which is a more detailed visual inspection with opening of cowlings and fairings and so on, and that gets performed every day at the end of every flight. at the end of the day.
And we mentioned EASA directives. One thing you mentioned that's been action since is this, is it 8-hour check for the lubrication system? Talk us through the results of that.
So what they found with the vertical shaft failure and the result of the two ditchings last year was that there was residual stress and hot spots within the vertical shaft as a result of the manufacturing process. What has happened with the gearbox in operation with hot oil, hot air, and then the cooling, the moisture, and the meshing of the gears and bearings and so on, is that you get this this deposit, which they're calling mud. Basically, it adheres to the inside of the vertical shaft and it traps moisture. With this moisture, you get active corrosion. So now you have active corrosion, residual stress, and stress hot spots. With these three factors, we have seen that the vertical shaft can crack. So one airworthiness directive that was released last year was to perform NDI inspection, non-destructive inspection, using an ultrasonic procedure. So this ultrasonic procedure gets carried out every 8 hours. So once the 8 hours have elapsed, the aircraft's pulled into the hangar, these experts in the NDI process then perform this inspection on the helicopter, and it will detect early indication of cracks on the vertical shaft.
Simon Meekins from Bond says their pilots guide passengers through every step before each flight.
Once they've gone through the security checks and made sure that they're not carrying anything that they shouldn't be out offshore, then we kit them up into survival suits, which they must wear all throughout the year. They have to wear a life jacket as well, again, because we're going to be operating over the sea. They must have the full survival kit and be wearing that, as we will as pilots as well. They then get a safety brief on the specific type of aircraft they're flying, which is normally a 10-minute or so DVD, which gives information exactly on all the emergency exits, all the safety equipment, and all the parts of the aircraft that they're going to be flying on. Very similar to what you would do when you get onto your airliner and you watch the stewardesses doing their job. We also highlight, once the guys get onto the aircraft, we have safety cards, again, exactly like you would have on your civilian airliner, on your commercial airliner, I should say, safety cards that give you all that information. So very similar, but working on safety throughout.
These survival suits, then, this is something that, you know, you have a body system, everyone checks these survival suits before, you know, as you're putting them on, so
yes,
that they're completely secure even before you're boarding this craft.
No, that's absolutely right. The survival suits need to be correctly fitted. They've got to fit the person who's wearing it. They need to be fully done up as well. You know, if the zip's not done properly, if they don't fit properly, then they may not work properly. So it's very important to get people checking each other to make sure that's done correctly. Equally, with the life jacket, the guys must make sure that they're attached and secured correctly. Again, that buddy-buddy system is used to do that.
You mentioned for Bond, one difference, that the pilots, they come through and they take people out to the craft. Why is it important for Bond that process happens, rather than, as you say, on a plane, we'll just hear from the pilot as we're on the plane?
It's about being able to show our customers, who are the guys going offshore, exactly who we are. We think it's really useful to have a face rather than be just on the end of an intercom system, which can sometimes be a little bit difficult to hear on an aircraft, on a noisy aircraft. And it gives us the chance to give the guys a good warning as to exactly what's going on the flight, so what the weather conditions are going to be like, and anything else that might affect them during that flight.
Meanwhile, MPs will debate helicopter safety next week, following calls for a full public inquiry into recent incidents.
The North Sound Energy Week with Active Payroll. Become part of an award-winning team. Go to activepayroll.com/careers for your next move.
And rounding off the week, 80% of oil bosses think the sector will be taxed more if Scotland becomes independent. That's according to a survey by Ernst & Young. It comes despite the Scottish Government insisting they won't raise taxes on the oil industry if we vote yes next year. Here's Energy Minister Fergus Ewing.
That's a vote of confidence in the Scottish Government and the strategy that I helped devise with the industry, that we maximise production and we do not punish them with punitive tax rises that they've seen from the UK Government all too often in the past, most recently in 2011. We are suggesting that they should not pay extra tax. The tax is already at the rate of over 80%. I mean, the tax rate seems to be high enough, and we do not want to drive away investment to other parts of the world. To make sure the investment remains in the North Sea and west of Shetland, there must be stability, predictability, no overall increase in the tax burden. That's what the SNP government's promised. And this survey proves that industry recognise that that's the right policy and one that they, I think, support.
Tax partner at Ernst & Young, Colin Pearson, says the sector needs more reassurances about the future.
The survey is, the intention is to, we surveyed approximately 140 leaders within the oil and gas sector, and the aim was to gather their views on the impact of the referendum was having on their business and what their expectations were as a consequence of a yes or no vote. It's quite clear that people don't feel that they have enough information yet. The majority said they needed more information. This is a big decision. It's an intergenerational decision and people really want to kick the tyres on it, and so I think there's an expectation that both sides of the campaign, the yes and no campaign, come out with some more meaty information to allow people and business and to make take a view on what way they should vote. People really want to get some real policy and direction as to what's going to happen if there's a change, because I think people's expectation is if there's a yes vote, there's bound to be change, whereas the survey says if there's a no vote, people, a large expectation is that there's no change. So particularly around tax rates, there was 80% of oil and gas leaders expected there to be some increase in tax take from the oil and gas sector, whereas if there was no vote, the 80% said they expected no change. So there was clear message to the Scottish Government there that they needed to engage with the sector more to provide them with more confidence, because at some point that must have an impact on the investment decision making. There's a gap there, isn't there? Even this week the recent notes around the reductions in corporation tax to stimulate economic activity by the Scottish Government. That's what they're saying, but that's not what people are hearing. The business community in the oil and gas sector, is the expectation is that there will be an increase in tax. So that, I think there's a clear message around the engagement between the two bodies to try and close that gap.
Don't forget, for the latest news in the energy sector, tune into our special Energy Zone bulletins each weekday morning on North Sound during breakfast. That's it for this week. This has been the North Sound Energy Week podcast. I'm Finlay Duncan.
The North Sound Energy Week with Active Payroll. Become part of an award-winning team. Go to activepayroll.com/careers for your next move.